Hagert, and a team of seasoned fundraisers. The course begins on January 21st. For more information, visit humboldt.edu/fundraisingcertificate or call 707-826-3731. Super Saturdays are a collaboration of Changing Tides Family Service, CalFresh, College of the Redwoods, and the local Child Care Planning Council of Humboldt County. Local educators will meet for an early childhood educator training on Saturday, February 8th from 9 a.m. to noon at the College of the Redwood Child Development Center in Eureka. Training topics will include Don't Be Afraid to Make Mess, Rainy Day Movement, and Circle Time, Story Time. The trainings will give providers an opportunity to learn, share ideas, network, and earn certificates of professional development. Spanish translation will be provided. Sign-in and refreshments will begin at 8:30 a.m. Information and registration is available by calling 444-8293 or emailing info@changingtidesfs.org. And support for KMUD comes from listeners like you and from Cutting Edge Solutions and Ferndale Music. Cutting Edge Solutions, keeping California green by providing custom blended fertilizers coupled with indigenous biological additives such as Humtea, G-Rex, and T-Rex. Cutting Edge Solutions, the Northern California is available at nurseries and outdoor gardening shops throughout Northern California. Ferndale Music Company at 385 Main Street, Ferndale. They offer quality used and vintage instruments, lessons, and fun. They're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 5, and Saturday, 11 to 3, and can be reached at 786-7030 or online at ferndalemusiccompany.com. And due to our live broadcast today, we will be bringing you TUC Radio early. And right at top of the hour, Marianne will be bringing you the live broadcast of the Water Conference. So for right now, here's TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. This is part two of a global survey of community currencies, grassroots credit clearing, and regional mutual aid systems. These are creative attempts to fill a role that the current monopoly system of bank money not only fails to fill but often undermines. Bernard Liotard is a former central banker and fund manager turned university professor, and the Irish journalist Jackie Dunn is CEO of an enterprise that gives advice how to restore the earth. Published in 2013, their book, Rethinking Money, is the most up-to-date international overview over complementary currencies and alternative systems of credit. The real-life projects that they describe fall roughly into two categories: exchange systems that renew social bonds while helping individuals and neighborhoods to manage their needs for help, food, local trade, healthcare, and education, and larger regional credit clearing and exchange systems that can actually create permanent jobs and substantial infrastructure like farms, gardens, and parks, housing, and public utilities. Among the 4,000 new currencies and credit systems in use today are several that have already been active and strong for decades, even up to 80 years, as in the case of the Vier Bank, founded in Switzerland in 1934. It's a business-to-business credit clearing system. And then there's history. Liotard and Dunn write that complementary currencies and trading systems have existed in many places for hundreds and even thousand plus years. As, for example, in Bali. It was once considered normal that two currencies were in use at the same time, one for long-distance trade and another for local exchanges, specific to the needs and desires of a given community. The advent of a global system of finance and commerce put dual pressure on these local creations. The new private bank monies, masquerading as state or federal currency, were made to seem like the only legitimate exchange system. And the central banks and governments in many cases outlawed local currencies. For example, during the Depression, very strong and successful local exchange systems were made illegal in Austria, Germany, in the US and other countries. For instance, in Bali, the World Bank withheld funds until a 1,000-year-old cooperative currency system of rice growing and water allocation was destroyed. Here are just a few of the exchange systems that Liotard and Dunn mention in their book, Rethinking Money. LETS stands for Local Exchange and Trading System, founded in Canada in 1983 in response to a wave of unemployment. Their networks use interest-free local credit for barter among the members. For instance, a member may earn credit for doing gardening for one person and spend it later on carpentry with another person in the same network. In LETS, no paper scrip is issued, and transactions are recorded in a central location, open to all members. Less than 10 years later, the economist Edgar Kahn initiated one of today's most rapidly expanding systems, time dollars. Time banking uses units of time as currency and is primarily used to provide incentives and rewards for community service, such as mentoring children, caring for the elderly, building or restoring houses, and improving the neighborhood. In 1991, a retired Supreme Court judge in Japan picked up the idea of a time-based exchange in the service of elder care. He laid the groundwork for the Furya Kipu, which translates into caring relationship ticket. The goal is to provide elders and disabled people with the services not covered by the Japanese National Health Program. Those who shop, clean house, or help bathe, or read for the elders earn credits in time that they can use immediately or save for the future or transfer to benefit parents or relatives in another part of the country. As of the writing of the book, Rethinking Money, 387 Furya Kipu systems operated in Japan, and they are beginning to be adopted abroad. For the Japanese government, this service, that required no state funding, is a huge money saver. Elders receiving Furya Kipu care are able to live longer independently in their homes and place fewer demands on expensive nursing care. The Chiemgau of southern Germany was created in 2003 by six young women and their teacher at a Rudolf Steiner school in Bavaria. Their goal was to support local small businesses against chain stores and to create employment. In 2012, the Chiemgauer had 600-plus participating businesses and created a very impressive over 6 million euros worth of exchanges of goods and services in 2011. The famous 80-year-old Wir Bank in Switzerland came out of the financial crisis of the 1930s and was founded in 1934 by two businessmen who lost their line of credit with their banks and were facing bankruptcy. Business A needed the bank loan to buy goods from Business B, which in turn needed money to buy materials from its suppliers. they realized that they did not really need the bank as a go-between. If they could create a mutual credit clearing system in which they dealt directly with their suppliers and customers. In 2012, some 60,000 businesses were members. The Vir Bank now employs 205 people at its headquarters and has 7 regional offices. In 1934, private banks in Switzerland fought hard to prevent the opening of the Vir Bank. Had they succeeded in outlawing the bank, Switzerland might look different today. That's according to Professor James Stoddard at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. His research shows that Switzerland's legendary economic stability and employment security is due in good part to the counter-cyclical effects of the Vir. There's a photo in the book Rethinking Money taken in an immigrant part of Ghent, the fourth largest city in Belgium. This is a poor area with squalid high-rise homes, crime and unemployment. The photo shows an open space that is now home to row after row of community garden plots. Bernard Liotard had been asked by the city administrators to suggest a solution to the urban decay and sense of desolation in that part of town. He began by doing a survey, asking the residents what they most wished to see. A small plot of land to raise vegetables and flowers was the top vote-getter. Liotard then asked the city of Ghent to make available an abandoned piece of land and to issue a local currency. The Turukas are paid for work to beautify the neighborhood, plant trees, clean up after sports events, over 500 services in all. The garden plots can only be rented with Turukas, but this community currency also pays for rides on buses, buys green products like compact fluorescent light bulbs, or special offers of healthy food. The local currency can even be converted into euros at the city office. Within the last 30 years, credit clearing systems have grown in scale, and Bernard Liotard, at a workshop in Petaluma in March 2013, described the very recent 3C system. He appreciates and recommends it in large part because it provides support for small businesses. Here's Bernard Liotard.
How many of you have experience in small businesses? Wow, this is an enlightened small business community. Let me tell you the problem that you know. It's called cash flow. Right? I see a couple of nodding. Why? As a small business, if you buy something from a big company, say IBM, a computer, you're going to pay cash, or you're going to pay 30 days if you're very lucky. If you sell something to them, there's 0% chance that they'll pay you cash, and you're lucky if they pay you 90 days, right? So when you try to grow, you need to put more and more capital in. Or you go to a bank, and the bank will tell you predictably, you're too small to be interesting, okay? Or they have a product called factoring that will cost you 10 or 20% of your invoice. There is a solution. And let me emphasize, small and medium-sized business equals jobs. 80% of all private jobs are held or maintained by small businesses. The media invariably talk about the big ones. When General Motors gets in trouble, boom, 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 5,000 jobs lost at 10,000, that's all over the page. But when there are 10,000 small businesses disappearing with 100,000 jobs disappearing, you don't see notice about it. So, if you want to address the job issue, and I believe America, this has become a critical issue, that's the solution that you need to look at. And what I'm going to present to you is the solution that initially was developed in Brazil and Uruguay, which is working. The software is available in open source, so you can start tomorrow morning if you want. Here's how it works. Let's assume that I am a small business. Let's assume that you are obviously IBM, I mean, a big player, right? You are one of the suppliers to him. So here's how it works. I have an invoice that I have issued to IBM for $100,000. They said, okay, we'll pay you in 90 days. I take that invoice. I have it insured by an insurance company. The cost of an insurance of that type in Uruguay is 1%. Why so little? Because the likelihood of IBM going bankrupt in 90 days is literally zero. Right? Fine. So, that insured invoice, what will it mean is, if he doesn't pay me in 90 days, the insurance company will, and go after him. But an insured invoice, I introduce it in an electronic network. And I get immediately 100,000 C3 units. C3 stands for commercial credit circuits in English. With this 100,000 C3 units, I go to my supplier and I say, I owe you $50,000. I'm going to pay you now 50,000 C3s, or you wait 90 days and I get you for dollars. Say, well, you know, this, I like to get paid now, but what the hell do I do with the C3, right? And here's the answer. We have an agreement with the bank. You can get out and get dollars now, for example, to pay your taxes. However, you pay the interest for the 90 days or whatever the amount of time will be outstanding, plus the banking fees. That's your problem. Or you look for one of your suppliers and tell the same story. So the stuff spreads around. That is a way of injecting working capital into small businesses at a very low cost. The only cost in there is 1% for the initiator. He or she on the small business is the one who decides the timing and the amounts, which is something that doesn't happen normally. When you go to a bank, they don't tell you, you know, when you get it and how much you, they decide that for you. And with that, you actually don't distort the market. Okay? Because if you try to provide subsidies to small businesses, that's hopeless. Because you're going to create all kinds of businesses that don't exist, that are not viable. These are businesses that have issued a viable invoice approved by my friend Sergio. You know, nobody will question that, right? So there we go. So that's the system. Anybody can always get out to a bank and get to normal money. In Uruguay, they also accept it in payment of taxes. Okay? So why can they do that? For the simple reason that this is actually the C3s are guaranteed to become national money in 90 days. Once you have a large network, and this network, the power of this network is that it expands by the client pushing the supplier to come in. It cannot fail unless the insurance company also fails, right? So the rating of the quality of the C3 unit is actually the quality of the insurance company. So look for a AA or something. When the bank is approached by one of the other players, it doesn't look at the other player. It gets the C3 units backed by the insured invoice. So the bank has an insurance that this, you know, this will be paid in 90 days or 80 days or 70 days or 50 days, whatever it will be remaining by then. It has that as a backing. So it will also look at just the process of what is the quality of the insurance company. And very often the bank owns the insurance company. So they're not really getting out of them. And the system is being paid. The cost for the system, you charge it at the moment of the exit. You want to discourage exit. Okay, if the bank charges 5%, you charge 6. You know, 6 total, one extra. And this 1% pays for the whole thing. It's the people leaving the system that pay for it. Let me tell you how the big ones finance themselves. That way. This is not new, and it happens all over the world, huh?
That was the former central banker Bernard Liotard from Belgium. He's a fellow at the Center for Sustainable Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. He ended his presentation with an appeal to take the current crisis seriously and to go beyond ideology and its past confrontations.
The communist system, the Soviet system, used the same money system as America. The only difference was the banks were owned by the government. In the capitalist system, the governments own the banks only when they're in trouble. But it's the same system. We have the Cold War behind us. The Cold War was about two ways of organizing the industrial age. Control, market. It's the patriarchal system, which is now dying. For the first time since the 13th century, women are more educated than men. So it's quite predictable that we're going to be in another system, and it's already there. And we're not talking just about women, by the way. We're talking about value systems. Right? We're talking about value for the feminine versus the masculine. That's really what matters. Now, we are at the point where I think we're going to have to break through to a planetary wisdom civilization, or we're going to regress to a level that we don't want to be here. The CIA study in 2010 has 75% of humanity will disappear. That will be the logic, 75%. We're going to drop down to less than 2 billion. Okay? They know more than I do, right? About the normal world, quote unquote. They don't have
natural
to do
disasters,
it.
Natural disasters.
No, it's going to be resource wars, water wars, and a little nuclear war between India and Pakistan would get you there rather quickly, right? That's the kind of stuff. So in the normal way of thinking, or power games will be the way of getting out of the mess with the kind of climate change that we're preparing, it's going to be very messy. So that's what they claim. I refuse to believe this. But that's why I'm standing here. I say there is another way. We have the capacity to break through. And one of the key tools that we claim, we will not make it if you keep believing that we need to do everything with a single currency of the type that we have now. Sustainability is unthinkable unless we rethink money. We need to get out of that box. I'm not claiming it's enough. It's a necessary condition, not a sufficient one. Okay? That's
what we all want.
That's what we want. A new balance between masculine and feminine energy that actually creates a biosphere on this planet and protects it.
Bernard Lyotard then responded to a question how to get things started. Here's what he had to say.
Let me give you one rule of thumb that has appeared in several of the systems. For example, the Toroka system. Use pull rather than push. The dream of the garden. My own dream. And if you create a bridge between what the city in Ghent or whatever the entity is, wants to achieve, make a bridge between what the dreams are, what the people want, and what you want to achieve. That's the link. So the first step would be make a survey of what people really want, and then create that bridge. Now, this country needs urgently C3 units. And the joblessness is getting pretty desperately serious. The problem of students leaving university with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and no job is criminal. It needs to be solved. The conventional system hasn't done it, has pushed them down. So we can do something about that. We need to create jobs for these people quickly, massively. C3s will do that. So this is what I would say the priorities are. There's one other one that I haven't mentioned here, which is healthcare. My claim is that no country in the world has a healthcare system. They have a medical care system. Now, in a medical care system, what are the incentives? It's very simple. You need to have people sick and alive. If you're not sick and not alive, you're not interesting. Okay? So this is a machine to keep sick people alive. It is not about creating health. So what is the solution? It's being implemented, as Jackie mentioned, in Ireland this year. It's called wellness tokens. Creating new habits. Well, you would have tokens, health, wellness tokens, for healthy habits. Okay? For losing pounds when you're overweight. Because we know statistically what the probability of a heart attack or diabetes and all the stuff that relates to that. For healthy activities, for healthy food, you give tokens for that. You need an alliance, a wellness alliance, and in Ireland it's already being created now, where actually the organizations, and that includes the government and includes corporations, who are actually end up paying for the diseases that are being generated in the current system. So they are the ones who will make the savings. They would organize the system and redeem the tokens. But if I earn the tokens, what can I do with them? I can have other healthy products, healthy services, preventive medicine, preventive activities, gyms, stuff like that. People can then redeem them with the Wellness Alliance for a fraction of the savings that are generated by having a more healthy process. So it's a statistical thing. So that's one example of what I believe this country needs. The wellness token and C3s. What we are talking about is actually the need for a monetary ecosystem, right? Systems at different scales, all the way from the global level to your neighborhood level with everything in between. Okay, and it's not just geographical. They could be non-local communities. It could be network communities. It could be interest communities. So that is what is needed.
And Bernard Leotard concluded with a surprising dream forward into 2400, when maybe, just maybe, money of any form will no longer be needed.
By the way, my perfect yin currency is the gift. When you get to a certain point where community is strong enough that you don't need currency, that's a breakthrough. And a good example for that is happened in Tacoma Park in near D.C., where they had used 3 years of currency, and afterwards they got rid of it because they don't need it anymore. Everybody knows what they're doing, what they like doing. Everybody contributes. There are no people who try to pull out more than they can give. And they are ready to reintroduce it. If some new people come into the community and start abusing it, let's reintroduce the currency. The same thing happened in Bali. Yeah? In Bali, we have a system for now 1,200 years. In Bali today, there are 3,000 complementary currency systems. Every banyar has one. And the system is, let's not use a currency unless there is an abuse. Let's say there's a complaint, then we reintroduce the currency. The system is ready to go, okay? But we don't need to use it all the time. We just need it when there is some people who are not getting the point anymore. So I'm considering this field of complementary currency as an education tool. Okay? And the future goes back to Star Trek with Picard. You know, I says in 2400, we don't have money. They don't have conventional money, and they don't have complementary money. Everybody does what they're passionate about. Everything gets done for developing their own person and their community, and it works. That's the future. But to get there, we need to rebuild the muscles that have been atrophied by 5,000 years of a monopoly of a young currency.
How much does this thing cost?
The economics of the future are somewhat different. You see, money doesn't exist in the 24th century.
No money? You mean you don't get paid?
The acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force in our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of Star Trek's First Contact. That was part two of a one-hour program on Rethinking Money, a book by Bernard Leotard and Jackie Dunn. Leotard is former banker with the Belgian Central Bank, fund manager, and now university professor. His co-author is the Irish journalist Jackie Dunn. Published in 2013, the book is the most up-to-date international overview over complementary currencies and alternative systems of credit. This program was recorded on March 4, 2013 in Petaluma, California. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program on Rethinking Money by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org or 707-463-2654 for more information. My name is...
Good morning, everyone. That was a special time for TUC. We're making room for a live broadcast from the Octagon at Beginnings Octagon in Bryceland. We're going to be broadcasting live from the Salmonid Restoration Federation and Sanctuary Forests North Coast Water Conservation Workshop. That's coming up in just a moment. Support for KMED comes from the New Settler interview, this issue, Running with Goats, Defending the Homeland. High up on a wick drain stitch, the intricacies of the citizen uprising in Willits, plus the women in Mendocino County Jail, and the return of Indian burning. An heirloom issue, the New Settler is now available at Wildberries, Arcata, Cafe Menu in Garberville, and Park and Take It in Laytonville. Also, KMED programming is underwritten in part by Weathertop Nursery in Laytonville on Harmon Drive. They have all that gardens need inside and out, including a wide variety of annuals, perennials, shade trees, and houseplants, as well as bare root trees. Weathertop Nursery is open Monday through Saturday from 9 to 5 and can be reached at 984-6385. You are tuned to Redwood Community Radio. This is KMUD and KMUD HD1 Garberville 91.1. KMUE and KMUE HD1 Eureka Arcata 88.1. And KLAI Laytonville 90.3. And we're also in Shelter Cove at 99.5 and on the web at KMUD.org. All right, let's go to, stay tuned. We're going to our live broadcast.
Welcome. Thank you for participating in the North Coast Water Conservation Workshop. I'm Dana Stolzman, the Executive Director of Salmonid Restoration Federation, a statewide nonprofit organization that is based here in Southern Humboldt. SRF promotes restoration, stewardship, and recovery of California native salmon populations through education, collaboration, and advocacy. We are concerned about restoring habitat, recovering native salmon species, and improving in-stream flows for all residents, human and fish. This historic drought in California and the West has spawned dialogue amongst legislators, regulators, water districts, landowners, and most importantly, neighbors. Salmonid Restoration Federation, Sanctuary Forest, and Friends of the Eel River wanted to convene this water conservation workshop to explore how we steward water, water conservation practices and programs to reduce water usage, and potential solutions and incentives that can help reduce our water footprint. There are immediate resources we can employ and measures, and we can also employ, and there are goalposts that we need to move in order to ensure water security on the North Coast. We are some of the most fortunate residents on the planet. We know where our water comes from, and we trust in its purity. For centuries, people have lived on the North Coast confident that the winter rains would provide enough water to get us through the dry season. Yet we live in a Mediterranean climate with an altered landscape. The cumulative effects of a growing population, thousands of unregulated water diversions, and this extended drought means that we need to rethink how we store and steward water. Adding winter water storage to rural properties is one solution that can significantly increase flows for people and fish. This workshop will address water issues, obstacles, resources, and solutions to help us conserve our most precious resource, water. I would like to thank all of the local residents who are participating in this water conservation workshop, K-Mud listeners, Bryceland Vineyard, our presenters, Tasha McKee from Sanctuary Forest, Scott Greason of Friends of the Eel River, Sarah Schramer of Salmonid Restoration Federation, Mark Lancaster, the director of Five Counties Salmonid Conservation Program, and Brian Johnson, the executive director of Trout Unlimited. I would also like to thank Aquadam for displaying two bladder tanks outside that they will actually be donating to the beginning school to increase their water storage. And Michelle Wood for preparing a delicious lunch for participants. The format of this day is as follows. We will have several presentations followed by a panel discussion. At 12:15, we will break for a networking lunch followed by a water rights clinic or field tour. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Scott Greason, who is the executive director of Friends of the Eel River, an attorney and an avid researcher on the paleoclimate record of the West.
Thanks, Dana. I suspect I get that last line because I've started reading The West Without Water, a volume I highly recommend. This is a 2013 publication from B. Lynn Ingram and Francis Malamud Rome. Again, The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climactic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow. This book was written in 2010, 2011, and published in 2013, and references the drought of 1976 and 77 as a historic low point in California's precipitation, a real reminder in the author's mind that things could get really bad, that we could face in California a situation where precipitation really failed for a couple of years in a row and took us to the very edge of the historic experience. The 1976-77 drought was quite a bit more severe than all of the previous events in then-recorded California history. Many of you remember that time and those challenges. Of course, today we now face a drought that is, again, a significant step more severe, not an order of magnitude, but a big chunk more severe than the 76-77 drought, and we may well be facing a much more extended drought. So I want to talk a little bit about what some of the lessons of science and history are in terms of where we are now, where we could be going. And I want to do that in the course of talking about the context of this drought for this community, and to suggest that what's happening now may well be an indicator of what is to come, that we are very likely going to face water stresses like this and quite a bit more severe than this in the years to come, and that those stresses are likely to raise questions of the most profound sort for this community and other communities around California. But of course, because this community is unique in some ways, our challenges will also be unique. I was just listening last night to a piece on the Capital Public Radio talking about water stress around California and what's happening to various communities. And they said, you know, the places that are going to get hit the hardest are small rural communities that don't have the financing to deal with infrastructure, and farmers and ranchers whose incomes and lives are tied directly to precipitation and the water they can use. Sound familiar? Yeah. So I do think we need to be realistic and understand that this is the kind of event that's likely to have a profound and traumatic impact on our community. Of course, my focus, the Friends of the Eel, is the impacts on the ecosystem and especially on fish. And it's the most basic idea of fish biology, that fish need water. I started already with the paleontology of climate, but I need to back up a little bit and talk about what's actually happening right now in terms of the weather. How long have I got, Dana? I'm going until 10:20. Well, somebody will tell me. Okay. Most of you already know this, but just to back up, what we're dealing with right now, the weather guys are calling the ridiculously resilient ridge. There's a high-pressure mountain of air off of the Pacific coast that is very much like what we deal with in the summer. That's what keeps water from coming to the California coast in the summer. But we've got it built up in the winter. That's driving the storm track of the jet stream up into Alaska. It's also bringing us cold weather at times. It's bringing us inland winds that can be quite dry, and we need to remember that when we think about fire danger. And it's also what's leading that weakened jet stream to divert both north around us and then south into the continental U.S., and so it's bringing the extreme cold to the rest of the U.S. Again, this is unusual, but we've seen things like this in the last 150 years. But again, if you look at the record in the tree rings and the records in sediment cores that you can take from lake bottoms and from estuaries and streams, that tells us that we have seen episodes like this in the last 1,000 years that are quite a bit drier and have lasted, you know, up to 150 to 200 years. So just ponder on that for a minute. Those are the kinds of changes that drive, you know, not just landscape scale changes in ecosystems, but have actually wiped out cultures. We saw the Hohokam culture in southern Arizona pretty much vanish during that drought in the 1500s. And again, what we are looking at right now, if our precipitation stays on track this year, is the driest year since 1580. So, yeah. What we're hearing from climate researchers compounds this analysis. I mean, history is important because what has happened before can and is likely to happen again. But what we're doing to the climate is moving the whole system steadily toward the boundaries of that historic range of variability. In many ways, that concept of the historic range of variability is beginning to break down. And what the climate models that are most successful in reflecting current conditions tell us is that over the next 50 to 100 years, we're very likely to see increased temperatures and patterns that reflect what we're seeing right now, that these temperatures and these patterns are likely to be the new normal by 2030 and likely to be extremely wet in the context of 2100. Just want to let that sink in for a minute. Right now we're facing what Mike Furness, a friend of mine, a geomorphologist and hydrologist and climate change planner, calls a blue water drought. The surface streams, the springs, are drying up. We're facing really very dire conditions in terms of stream flows. We see stream flows that are, you know, what we'd see in spring, in the summer. But what we're getting into now with an extended drought is a green water drought, where we actually don't have enough water in the soil to support our vegetation. And we're seeing soil moisture conditions and fuel moisture conditions right now that are approximately the same as we'd see in the summer in a situation of real fire risk. If we don't see a break in this set of conditions next fall, we need to start getting really very, very serious about planning. But as I've suggested, whether or not this particular event breaks, it raises a kind of challenge for all of our communities, and particularly communities like this one, that says we have to start thinking about how we're going to deal with these conditions. And I think while a lot of the discussion today is necessarily and I think very usefully about what we can and should do at home, on our own homesteads, in our own lives, the greater challenge is what do we do as a community? And here I think we can't escape the reality that the already fraught question of water use is complicated immensely here by the fact that the marijuana industry is such an important part of the equation here. Put it this way, the question of fairness, of equity, is one that's absolutely central to water use. And when you think about what you need to take care of yourself and your family, that's kind of an absolute thing. There's ways in which you can reduce your water use, and we all can and should. But when you come down to it, you need water. There's no replacement for it. We can't substitute for water. And it's entirely just that we should work together with our neighbors and share what there is. But if you don't know how much your neighbor's taking, and they're not willing to be transparent and open with you about how much they're taking and why, those are the situations in which a lot of resentment, a lot of misunderstandings, and a lot of difficulty can ensue. So I think while water can be the medium for a lot of cooperation in the long run, in the short run, it's likely to be a context in which people have often sharp disagreements. And I think this is the lesson of the arid West in a lot of ways. And what we as a community are dealing with right now is entering the real West, having been sort of an exception to the West's fundamental aridity. We now on the Redwood Coast are having to deal with being part of that dry country where cooperation is essential. That's really the lesson of the pioneers. It's not that the individual stuck it out and made it all on his own. It's actually that the people who work together and share prosper. And that's going to be a challenge for us. Another point about the weed industry, and I'll try to shut up about it after that. I think there's a real risk in these circumstances of the marijuana industry in California, and especially in the Emerald Triangle, losing the admittedly somewhat limited social license that we have from the rest of the state. And what I mean there, maybe by analogy, is what I saw in the course of the fight over cutting old growth in our forests. We said basically 30 years ago, these are ancient forests. We don't have the right to cut them all down and replace them with second growth. And at the time, that was a very challenging idea. But in the course of about 10, 20 years, with a lot of hard work, we did achieve this fundamental change. And it's not that old growth isn't still being cut, but the idea that we are going to rip it all down and replace it with second growth is now one that most people who are exposed to the issue find very, very hard to accept. No, we need to keep those old trees. By the same token, I think a lot of people in California are more than willing to see Humboldt County and the Emerald Triangle thrive on the marijuana trade, but not at the expense of the fish. And if, I guess I should start by saying, I take it as read as a fundamental premise that you folks here in this room, you folks who are hearing me on the radio, are the people who already care, are already motivated, are doing your best in all the ways you know how, and are here seeking more information about how to do better. The challenge for all of us is not just how do we reduce our own water use, it's how do we reach the rest of our community and ensure that we collectively are keeping the water in the creek. And when we look at the official system that's supposed to keep the water in the creek and supposed to allocate water fairly, there are a lot of ways in which that system comes up short. It is complicated. It is frustrating. It is almost stupid in many different respects. Thank you, John. It is not almost stupid. It is stupid. And as John Williams has pointed out, you know, understanding the history of California's water rights system can help you to see how it came to be the way it is, but it doesn't make it make sense. It just doesn't. So all that being said, if folks in this area don't want to work within the system of water rights, of reporting water diversions, and dealing with the existing agencies and structures we've got to deal with these questions, then I think the burden is really on the community to come up with something that's going to work to keep the water in the creek. If we can't do that, then we will lose the coho and the steelhead and the chinook that make this region unique. We have fish in these creeks that have been here for millions of years. They were here first. They are not the same fish that are in Alaska. They are adapted to here. I think we have to start with that basic idea that our biggest job is to make sure those fish can be here when our children are here. So that's where I'll start. Thanks a lot.
Let's see if this works. Am I coming on? Okay. Good morning. I'm Tasha McKee from Sanctuary Forest, and I see that Brian Johnson from Trout Unlimited has arrived, so he's going to be coming up and taking his place here at the end of the table and joining us at the end of the talks. I'm going to speak briefly about the Matol and what we've done there and what we know we still need to do and how that model can be expanded all over California, but certainly regionally on the North Coast. And then I'm going to pass it to Matt Cocking from NRCS, who's going to talk about some ways that NRCS can help landowners. Some of you here are from the Matol. It's great to see all these faces, first of all. I see people of all ages and people I know and people I don't know, and it's really encouraging. I'm going to be talking a little bit about India today, and because my son and I went a year ago, February 1st, actually, to Rajasthan, where they only get 24 inches of rain, and they've been working for 5,000 years developing a tradition. And I think I'm just going to start with India and then come back to Whitethorn. But they have water pilgrimages in India where people get together to share knowledge. And so I'd like to think of this as one of the beginning of many water pilgrimages where we're going to teach each other. And I guess really that's where I want to start, is that we don't know. When you start learning about what they did in India, this 5,000-year-old tradition, I'm just going to read you a line here that was from a book I was reading. It's this Gandhian concept, and Gandhi came after this tradition but really acknowledged it. And the way that the people work with water, it's a gift of labor. It's a service offered in a religious and respectful spirit. Working with water is the best work that you can do for your spirit and your place. And it's in their culture. It's part of their ethics. And it got broken down when England took over India, but it's being revived now. The gift of labor in the interest of all is the underlying spirit behind the water harvesting and conservation work. From the smallest of kunds, a kund is a small pool, and family tankas to the johads and talabs, and those are like these big lakes. And so what they had there passed on for 5,000 years was this incredible knowledge that was passed on from generation to generation of how to collect water in tanks like we know how to do here. We've learned that part, to store the water. And Sanctuary Forest, we have some things back there that can show you ways that we help collect the water with doing it so that if you're pumping out of the river, you've got a fish screen on the end so you're not hurting the fish, and ways to filter it. We're getting that technology down in the Matol. We're really getting that technology down. But They also store water in the ground, and we haven't learned that yet. And when I say that, there's lots of knowledge out there. There's a lot of permaculture knowledge. Kyle Keegan's going to be doing a workshop or hike with Sanctuary Forest this year to help teach about that. My main point here is that we are going to need to learn. And we don't have the luxury to keep doing things the way we've been taught. We all have been taught in this extractive civilization, the civilization that's used to having plenty and being able to waste resources. And we're going to have to really learn what it is to instead work with very limited resources and save every precious drop. And I think we don't know how much water we need. We don't know what's going to happen with this drought. But there's so much more that we can do than we have so far. One of the things that I want to talk about is the land use impacts, and that and at Sanctuary Forest, what we've learned is those land use impacts are even more significant than human use in terms of what's happening to the streams in the drought years. So in 2008, in the Mattole headwaters, all of the tributaries, except for two, stopped flowing. I'm just going to hold up a map for a moment. Can you hold that?
Sure.
So when I talk about the Mattole headwaters, can I pull this up? We're talking about this 28-square-mile area, and there's 14 fish-bearing tributaries here. And of those 14 fish-bearing tributaries in 2008, only two were left flowing. And many of these had no human use on them. Many of the ones that dried up had no human use. And so, and this year could be way worse than 2008. And so what we realized is that if we all left, if we evacuated, the rivers would have still dried up and there wouldn't have been enough for fish, going back to your point. And so if we're going to restore the land for fish, you can go ahead and set it down now. We need to at least restore the pools. And just one brief thing on that, and then I'll pass it on to Matt. There's a display I want to just point your attention to in the back on the Baker Creek project, where one of the ways, some of the land use impacts that we have are that our streams are entrenched. And when the streams are entrenched, we're draining our groundwater in many ways, but that's one of the main ways we're draining it, is when the stream is downcut, and you can go back there and see those drawings, it actually makes the groundwater drain faster. And then also we don't have very many pools in our streams because they're all the way down to bedrock, and there's no logs in there to make pools. So if we can even just get pools back in, what we're learning is fish actually, our coho have evolved to where they don't need flowing water necessarily between pools if the pools are deep enough so they don't dry up. So there are countless ways that we can learn, but this all requires learning. Doesn't work to just go out and say, okay, I want to make things better and I'm just going to start doing things. You can make things worse. So all these things require learning from each other in the sort of collective effort that Scott was talking about. There's also the problem of our forests being overstocked. And at this point, I'm going to pass it on to Matt, because NRCS does have some skills and knowledge, technical assistance that they can bring, and sometimes financial assistance with these land, how to just better steward your land. Thank you.
Again, that was Tasha McKee with Sanctuary Forest.
Hi, my name is Matthew Cocking. I'm a forester for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, servicing Humboldt County, but I also branch out to five other counties around us. So just a little bit about what the Natural Resources Conservation Service is, or NRCS. We federal employees like to use our acronyms a lot. The NRCS began as the Soil Conservation Service, actually, as a response to the Dust Bowl. And the purpose was to conserve soil resources at the time. Since then, it's grown into a much broader and larger federal agency that deals with all kinds of conservation issues. And being under the Department of Agriculture, we deal with rural or agricultural production and rural lands. So we have service centers across the country, and ours here in Humboldt County is off of Humboldt Hill, in Eureka, South Broadway, in the agricultural building there. And we offer assistance to landowners in the form of technical assistance, as Tasha mentioned. So you can call us and ask questions. We can even come to your property and answer questions there and talk about what we might know. But we also have financial programs that are available to private landowners who are in the agricultural sector or, in some cases, for some people that means rural. Forest landowners fall into that category as well. So we have an engineer, myself, a forester. We have a rangeland specialist in our office and a soil conservationist. And then we have other biologists, ecologists, engineers, et cetera, at our area office and our state office that we can tap into for knowledge. So there's a lot of information there that's available, in addition to financial help, which comes through the Farm Bill, which we're hoping to get passed soon here. Regardless, there still is, even if that isn't passed, there still is momentum and some financial assistance that can be available. So the things that we can do, all-encompassing conservation do include water conservation practices as well. So water storage, improving water use on agricultural properties for agricultural operations, that is something we can do in addition to improving the systems that supply us with water. So stream restoration, wetland type of projects we have been involved in. And we collaborate pretty well with other agencies as well, both state and federal, so we combine on private lands to do projects. And we're non-regulatory. We don't go out and cite people for doing something wrong necessarily. We simply want to try and help people do better conservation on their land. So
Can you talk to us a little bit about forests and fire?
Forests and fire? They go together in this part of the world. I guess I would add to what Scott said regarding the situation we're in right now, having a very, very dry year, and that fire risk you mentioned was going to be something to think about this year, and even in the winter we've been thinking about it and seeing fires in California right now, that we're in an unprecedented situation with forest conditions that come together for a perfect storm when we have really dry conditions. So we've lost a lot of fire resilience in forests right now as well, because we've had many decades of suppressing natural fires or fires that would have occurred to reduce fuels or reduce tree densities in our forests. So I would add that to what Scott said about something that we're going to have to deal with when fires come along is, you know, we have drier and drier years. We're not only dealing with the dryness of the year, but another artificial effect of our, you know, our fire suppression as a culture that we've applied here on the landscape. So,
and you guys can help with that too, with the forest.
Yeah, yes, we can. We can from fuels reduction to improving, you know, erosion off of roads to, you know, helping to build water storage for agricultural use and other issues. So, yeah. Okay. Oh, and I will add, with this year being so dry and unprecedented, there's some discussion about special initiatives for drought this year that may crop up. So it's something to keep your eyes on with various agencies, but ours as well. So.
And then we're going to go to Sarah and Dana next, actually.
That was Matt Cocking with the NRCS. And that, again, their office is up in Eureka at Humboldt Hill.
I'll just let folks know while we're in this technical transition that because this is live on KMUD, you know, feel free to just, you know, refresh your coffee, use the bathroom, but we're not going to take a break between now and the panel discussion.
Next, we'll be hearing from Dana Stolzman.
Just follow up for a second on what Matt was just saying. You know, the need to be prepared for a really serious fire year this summer only underscores the need for people to have stored water. You know, you need to have water stored for your homestead, but you also need to be prepared for a fire event we have not seen in local memory. And it will come. It may not come this year, but it will come.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Schramer, and I'm a graduate student at HSU in the Sociology Department. I also work with Dana Stoltzman at Salmonid Restoration Federation. And I'm just going to spend a few minutes to give an overview of a project that we've been working on. It's called the Redwood Creek Water Conservation Project. I think a lot of you, a lot of the faces here are familiar, so I think a lot of you have seen what we've been up to, so we're just going to give a quick overview. And what we've been doing is we've been trying to see if there are certain elements of the Sanctuary Forest Water Conservation Program that we can transfer to Redwood Creek. And the reason that this is a concern is because the South Fork of the Eel has long supported really important populations of coho and chinook and steelhead. And obviously stream flow is a big concern. That's why we're all here today. And so we chose Redwood Creek for a few reasons after a lot of deliberation. It has 5 populated tributaries, so we know that there are a lot of landowners living on the different tributaries that might be interested in participating, might be willing to change their behavior to help keep more water in the creeks. We know that all of the tributaries have historically supported strong runs of these different fish populations. We know that there's a proven record of stewardship in the watershed. And we also know that there are a lot of long-term residents in the watershed who already have expressed interest in participating in water conservation voluntarily. And so we've been thinking about this project in terms of having 2 components. One is ecological. Oh, yeah. One is ecological and one is sociological. And so in terms of the ecological component, what we've been working on doing is trying to figure out what the baseline data is, how much water is being used, where, what does the low flow season look like? Is it year round or is there a specific, you know, like in the Matoll, they have a 105-day dry season. And so we wanted to figure out if something similar exists in Redwood Creek. And so part of that process involves a lot of data collection and understanding the actual flows that are available and then how much water is being used by people. And the sociological component is a lot of what I've been helping with just with my training. So we've been working to gauge how interested folks are in participating in this because it is voluntary at this point. And, you know, the fact that you all are here, I think, is really indicative that there is an interest in the community of figuring out something that's going to work to keep the fish in the streams and to keep water in your tanks. So what we've been doing is working with a lot of different stakeholders to figure out what are some of the best avenues that we can provide for community engagement and participation so that the solutions aren't being dictated, that it's something that comes sort of from the bottom up and provides avenues so that people can come together and really develop solutions that make sense for this community because this place is different than the Matoll. It's different from Mendocino. You know, every watershed is unique and has its own landscape that has to be worked within. So that's another side of what we've been doing is really trying to make sure that there's room for dialogue and participation as long as folks are interested in that. So the first thing that we did, and this was following what Sanctuary Forest did when they were first gathering their data, is we sent out a survey questionnaire, and we sent it to parcel owners in the watershed. There were about 400, and we received around a 19% response rate. And we were pretty satisfied with this, considering how hard it can be to reach people, especially if they don't want to be contacted. So we did sort of a media blitz, and we went on the radio, and we sent out press releases, and we did everything that we could. We even had some folks kindly walking on their roads and going door to door and asking neighbors to fill out the surveys. But they were anonymous, and what we did is we asked folks to indicate some really simple questions like, what is the size of your garden? And we didn't ask what you grew in your garden, just what's the size of it. We asked, you know, are you interested in participating in a voluntary water conservation program? We asked, you know, what do you value about Redwood Creek? Do you value its habitat for salmon? Do you value it for drinking water? Do you get your water from the creek itself or from a spring? So we were really trying to collect a sense of what the human population was doing in the watershed. And we found some really interesting results. One was that we found the majority of people who responded were getting their water from springs rather than directly from Redwood Creek. And that's a significant difference between the between Redwood Creek and the Mattole. And so we don't exactly know yet what that means for the in terms of the hydrology, what the implications of that are, but it's something that's really important to be aware of. We also learned that more significant than any other factor was that people really valued the creek for its habitat for fish. And so that's a sort of overarching theme that we want to keep in mind as something that brings us all together. Aside from having water for our families, it's a respect for a different species that needs the resource as much as we do. Something else that I thought was really interesting was that out of all of the respondents, over a quarter didn't have any mechanisms on their tanks to prevent water loss. And this is one of the easiest things that you can do and the most affordable things that you can do to right away keep more water in the stream. And so that's something that we're going to focus on is trying to make sure that folks are aware of the different options that are available for keeping water from overflowing, like a float valve or a shutoff valve, things that can be really easily purchased and installed at a hardware store, for example. And for this project, we've also been focusing a lot on outreach and education, and again, that has a lot to do with making sure that everyone is aware that this effort is underway and has been since fall of 2012. So we've had a couple of community house meetings. We've done, actually almost a year ago today, we had the first water conservation workshop, and so it's really exciting to see probably three times as many people here, or at least twice, I think. And we've also done, we've just done a lot of different outreach efforts to make sure that we're kind of getting the word out about this. And we have a big vision that's been informed by the people we've been working with, a lot of the landowners and residents. The vision is that we'll follow some of the things that the folks in the Mattole did, and that might involve putting up tributary signs on the different tributaries in the watershed so that you can see, you know, when flows are really low, you know, to turn off your tanks, for example. We're also talking about water conservation corners at hardware stores. So, you know, it's really easy to find information about what you can do on your homestead or at your residence to conserve water, and all of that equipment is in one place, easily accessible. Another thing that we've been doing is looking at opportunities and obstacles. And so we're working with the Board of Supervisors. We're talking with elected representatives. We have a lot of different nonprofits that we're partnering with to remove as many barriers as possible, whether it's increased costs when it comes to installing more storage, to funding barriers, and then also helping to inform residents about their water rights and responsibilities. And that was part of why we hosted a water rights education forum this last summer in July. The purpose of that was to share information about state water law and to make it clear, you know, what you can do to be in compliance, so that when you're installing projects on your property to help conserve water, that you're doing it in a way that's not going to draw unwanted attention to your property or to your, you know, to your neighbors. That was just a photo of the workshop. And so I'm going to pass it over to Dina Stoltzman, who's going to talk about the flow study that we initiated this summer with the help of Bill Eastwood.
That was Sarah Schreimer with the Monmouth Restoration Federation. Nice to talk to the executive director.
Thank you so much. And for anyone who's in KMUD's listening audience, we'll make this PowerPoint available so people can see some of the graphs and so forth. I specifically want to thank and acknowledge Bill Eastwood, who has done a tremendous job with this initial year of low flow studies. And
he's a watershed hero.
And it truly would not have been possible without someone who loved this watershed, knew this watershed, and had Bill's level of, you know, as a geologist and someone who's done on-the-ground restoration. So I'm very proud of what was accomplished this first year. And again, I really want to emphasize that, you know, Redwood Creek is one watershed. It's 26 square miles. But why it's so significant is because the South Fork Eel River is absolutely key to the recovery of the endangered coho salmon. And when you look at recovery plans for endangered salmonids, it's broken into different evolutionary significant units, and we happen to live in a very significant place for the recovery of this species. So it was very assuring to see how many people were proud that we live in salmon habitat, but what does it mean when you cohabitate with endangered species? So I'm just going to quickly talk about some of the objectives. Some was to do outreach and educate landowners, also to recruit landowners with stream habitat monitoring. There will be a lot more opportunity for that next summer, because what we're really trying to do is identify what reaches are critical and where could there be potentially large-scale, multiple beneficial use projects. It's probably not going to look exactly like the Mattole. I think what might be more appropriate for Redwood Creek is some larger project that benefited multiple users, like Beginnings, the fire department. You know, I think we need to start really thinking collectively about what it's going to take to have water security and fire safety. We also want to determine what habitat improvement and flow augmentation techniques might increase juvenile salmonid habitat, and compare flows and habitat conditions. So one of the things that we would eventually like to do, if we're able to do more elaborate funding, is what's called a Bakke study. Looking at above and below diversion points would really provide some useful information. And because this watershed is so more spring dependent, eventually a groundwater study would be very fascinating and helpful to understand what is the difference between, you know, perpetually filling our tanks from springs opposed to, you know, diverting water. So is this what we're using? Oh. Okay. Anyway, this gives you a sense of, this is the Redwood Creek watershed. This is where the initial sites were set up. I would imagine that Bill Eastwood would be available for questions, and we have maps over there if people would like to see this a little bit better. And basically, the thing, because we started in a low flow season, and Sanctuary Forest usually was starting about August 1st, I believe, with their low flow studies, but, you know, getting some baseline data prior to that. We started different sites at different times, but we're talking really basic methods of being able to determine flows. And at the end, we were down to a bucket and stopwatch method. So this is a 7-foot long, 4-inch diameter pipe and a partial flume. And this to me is a very telling slide. Obviously, this is a culvert designed for a 100-year flood storm event. Obviously, it's big enough for Bill, Sarah, myself, and my dog all fit in that culvert. So you get a sense of, you know, here you can imagine the kinds of flows you've seen coming out of culverts in a big storm event, and you can see the trickle that we were down to. Most of the sites started at about, you know, the highest, I think, 48 gallons per minute. And by late July, many of them were running at less than a gallon per minute. So we're not even measuring CFS. If you can imagine that our tributaries are running at less than a gallon a minute, you can imagine how much one person diverting could dewater the stream immediately. So, again, the first sites were monitored starting late July. There were 11 monitoring sites in total. Most reaches still had minimal connectivity between pools. And as I said, you know, I think there was one site that was at 48 gallons per minute. And, you know, by late August or maybe even a little earlier, many of the sites were less than 1 gallon per minute, the flow. So many of those pools where we were seeing coho salmon were drying up. This, I think, is the best visual. I mean, we can break it into more detail you know, later at the table, but you can see that by late August, all of these flows were totally minimal, from between a 0 and 1 gallon. And one of the things that was a really interesting discovery was that we had those initial rains in September. You know, we thought, wow, maybe we're going to have a good year, right? Well, the pool stayed connected a lot longer than we would have thought. And Bill, bless his heart, went out there and continued to monitor, because we were kind of fascinated what level of additional flow kept these pools connected. And, you know, it actually wasn't that much. It was achievable to be able to keep pools connected within this watershed. And again, you know, week after week, we're seeing pools dry up that had juvenile coho salmon. And, you know, those are the ones that are in a few years are going to be our big grown-up salmon. So we can't afford to lose a year or two. So thank you, and we're happy to answer more questions and make that available on our website at calsalmon.org.
Do you want to announce about that people can ask questions at the panel?
Yeah, we're going to have a 30 minutes for a panel discussion, and we thought that was kind of better to field that all at the end. I'm very honored that Mark Lancaster came. here today. He's with the five-county Salmonid Conservation Program, and you can imagine how ambitious it is to try to provide resources for landowners in five counties in California, in particular five large rural counties in California. So Mark has a huge level of expertise and experience, and you look great. Thank you, Mark.
Hi. If I get too quiet. So I'm going to start. I'm Mark Lancaster. I can talk longer than you can listen, and unfortunately I only have 20 minutes-ish to do this, and if my zipper comes undone, tell me. But people on the radio won't know that. With only 20 minutes, I literally could talk longer than you can listen, I'm going to give you a little background on who I am and what brought me to water conservation. I started out in 1978 as a firefighter and a forester technician. I graduated from Humboldt State in forestry. I'm a registered professional forester in California, but I did land use planning for about 20 years in Trinity County as well as forest consulting, and I'm a timberland owner, so I'm vested in my timberlands. But I can try. So in 1998, we started a program in Northwest California called the Five County Salmonid Conservation Program. And ironically, we mostly deal with the other end of the scale, which is the flooding, because the flooding causes a lot of sediment, causes a lot of erosion, downcut streams, causes landslides. We get a lot of culverts that in floods blow out and become barriers to fish passage. So I've spent 15 years working on restoring the other end of the hydrologic cycle for fisheries, and fighting fire and doing forestry and a bunch of other stuff, which I'll try to tie in. But somewhere along the way, we'd spent about $1 million restoring a stream that we'd been studying for 10 years. And then that stream dried up right afterwards. And then we started noticing this more and more. And we have spent $20 million of the public's money in the last 15 years restoring fish habitat only to repeatedly see streams dry up that didn't dry up previously and to see algae blooms in channels that didn't have algae blooms before. So my first conclusion was, man, we're doing the wrong thing. Because whatever we do, it seems like algae blooms are following behind us. But I did go upstream, and I did find a series of illegal water diversions upstream. And I went to those people, and I said, you're done. You're out of here. Next year I come back with law enforcement, because I've spent $1 million downstream trying to restore fish habitat, and you're undoing it with a single pipe and a pump. And So I kind of started to realize, and I think Scott hit this really well, which is think of our fisheries as our ancient forests, if you will. We have an obligation. None of us can remove those, make them become extinct. And we are actually facing that a little bit in Northern California. The issue also is not limited to over here, and I've been lucky enough to work from the high desert to the coast and seen a lot of things. So I'm going to... Here goes. Hang on. We'll see what happens. This is Weaverville. Every photo in here is a photo I took, and it's real history. So I have no idea how to make this work. There's a lot you can do to prove to yourself what's going on. And so I'm going to start right here. This is obviously, we've all probably seen these. And for those on the radio, I apologize. We'll try to make this like talk radio. I'll try to make it controversial to keep you alert and awake. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a graph of Weaverville's fire weather precipitation records for the last 120 years. You can go to a place called CDEC, just Google CDEC, and you can pull up any weather station in California. And I encourage everyone to do this, and I'll show you why. This is 120 years of records. This is broken into 40-year sections of that 120 years. This band that they can't see on the radio represents 50% more rainfall than the average for Weaverville. And this one is 50% less rainfall than the average. So we're going to call this really wet and really dry. And that's going to be the arbitrary definition. Between 1895 and 1934, We had two really wet and really dry years, about one every 20 years. 1934 to 1974, we had one really wet or really dry year, about one every 40 years. From 1974 to 2012, we've had nine really wet or really dry years, a 450% increase in really wet, in really dry years. But guess what? The average rainfall hasn't changed at all. So we're still averaging 38 inches a year, but what we're seeing is this rapid ping pong, if you will, of weather. So if you're a water company or a landowner, you care about what's flowing in your creek today, not the average. And the fish are the same way. They cannot survive without water. And so this very erratic weather variation that we're seeing now is different than what we saw previously. And this holds true not for just Weaverville. This holds true in the Mono Basin, and it's almost identical. My guess is if you go to SeaDec, pick your favorite watershed, look at this, you might find the exact same result. So we have a climatic variation, which is really hard on the resources that we have, and it's increasing. I probably forgot to mention that of those nine, in the last 16 years, we had six of them. So the rate of those variations is actually increasing continually. We can Google a blue dot report. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory says we have 2 to 3 more years of this drought. This drought started 13 years ago. And there's a different perspective depending on who you are and where you are. And let me tell you, most of California doesn't really care about what's going on in the northwest corner for what I call surface water diverters. Because California mostly cares about these dots. And these dots are the reservoirs. And those provide the water to the vast majority of California. They're not really worried about whether you have surface water. They will be worried about whether the endangered plants and animals have enough water to some degree. But they're mostly worried about reservoirs. So in 2010, the State Water Board, that was a drought, because the reservoirs were down to 40%. In January 2014, it's just a reservoir condition. I want you to be aware that there are two different perspectives when it comes to water in California. There is the plumbing, the aqueducts, and the delivery systems, which are the major focus and concern of the state of California. And then there's us and what we have to work with. This is another problem, again, not so much for you guys, but this is an 8,000-foot peak out of Weaverville. This is January 2014. There should be about 8 feet of snow here, and there's not one drop of snow here. And this is the rainfall for the last 4 years in Weaverville. Am I doing okay with the mic? Okay. This is the average, buried way back here, and I apologize on the radio. It's a really cool-looking graph behind a really beautiful picture. And here in 2013, you can see we are absolutely flat line. That is the lowest year-round rainfall in history for our watershed. So just sort of give you a backdrop. And what you can't see right here is a fire. I'm going to come back and talk about that maybe if I don't run out of time. Couple of things. The solutions, according to the EPA, you got to adapt locally. That's where you're actually going to solve this problem, is through local adaptations. You have to be flexible and iterative. And this is probably the one I would take home the most. Hydrologic cycles of the past do not necessarily reflect hydrologic cycles of the future. So if you think you're considering investing in water conservation, and you like to do things like I do, like buy the stock when it's at the absolutely bottom and you miss it, well, it's the way with the water conservation. Go ahead and make your investment today. And even if it rains next year, trust me, you're going to get a payoff in your investment long term. Don't hesitate on the return of funds. So I want to talk a little bit about, we talked about this being a bad fire year. Actually, this is just the next bad fire year. We've had since, I'm going to go back to 1999 to today and talk about the Trinity River. We have burned up 25% of the forest in the Trinity River watershed in the last 15 years. And this drought, actually, if you go, Jet Propulsion Laboratory tells us this drought started 13 years ago. And the rate of forest loss to stand replacing high-intensity fires over the last two decades is faster and greater than any time in history. So you guys can think of yourselves as being a little bit closer to the coast. You have a little bit more buffer. But what's going on interior is that forests are being completely lost due to high-intensity replacing fires. This is particularly critical in our community because in between 2007 and 2009, we had 18 wildland firefighters killed in the Trinity and the Klamath River. So we're very aware of the potential for high-intensity fire. And I'll try to bring this back to water conservation. These are all the same fire. I'm a fireman. I got to throw fire pictures in. Some of the other issues, and this can get back to water conservation, is ecologically what's going on. So this is December 2011 on a creek in the Weaver Creek, and there was no rain. November, December were very dry. The Coho came upstream. They hit this beaver dam, which beaver dams are generally very good for fish. They provide excellent rearing habitat for young fish. Unfortunately, there was no flow in December. December is supposed to have about 12 inches of flow a year. In a normal year, this beaver dam would be overtopped. The fish would move upstream, and they would spawn upstream. We find ourselves in this erratic climatic condition of having to make tough choices between important ecological considerations. Do we modify this dam so fish can go upstream because we don't have normal flows? Or do we leave the dam and just say that three-year life cycle season for those fish will just be lost for now? They'll come back eventually. This is March of the same year, same dam. And this is May of the same year. No problem for the steelhead. They come up in March, lots of rain, dam not a problem. I will tell you this dam was actually removed by Caltrans. So there was kind of that was a solution to that, not necessarily the best one. So surface water diversion. I do a lot of fire planning, and the sociologist I work with tells me you have to scare people into action, but you can't scare them so much that they give up. So I'm going to try to not scare you too much. This is August 1987, my introduction to fisheries. This is a creek that was flowing a foot and a half deep, and it was a very hot day, and I was actually standing in the creek, and the creek dried up as if God had parted it instantly. I can't tell you how many thousands of fish died at that time, but the only thing I could do was go get a camera and document it, so I did. The issue, I was able to go upstream. I talked to the water truck that was pulling water out of the creek, and I asked him, did the creek dry up? And he said, no, not at all. And, in fact, it didn't. He was at a big pool, beautiful pool, lots of water flowing out of it. And he said, I don't understand. So I walked downstream. There were about 12 pumps in the creek. Everybody turned their pumps on in the middle of the day to water their lawns because it's hot. He happened to be there at the exact same time. I happened to be in the creek downstream. These fish died. This probably happens all the time. When he got done pumping water, the flows came back. All those dead fish disappeared. If you hadn't been misfortunate enough to be standing there in that instant, you would never know that thousands of fish had been killed. This is September 2010, a different creek out of Weaverville. Every single day, people would turn their pumps on. Every single day, fish would die. So we couldn't deal with it, so we documented it. These guys are relying on fish. That's a glacier. I got right off my taxes, my trip to Alaska. So So here's the model. Reduce, reuse, recycle. We all know that one. So I made my own up. The five things you can do for water conservation. Repair, reduce, reclaim, rethink, restore. And I'm going to try to talk about those real quick. Am I out of time? Okay. Tell me, give me like a two-minute warning. Number one, if I can ask everyone to do one thing, and if you heard me on KMUD, do not pump out of a creek or a spring ever directly. Don't do it. Put it into a tank and pump out of a tank. The reason is that if you pump out of the creek, this little creek right here, this is my house, if you pump out of this creek and you pull 10 to 15 gallons a minute or 5 gallons a minute, you are going to drop that creek. If someone down the way turns on a pump at the same time, they're going to drop that creek. And you literally cannot, I can promise you right now, you can let water bypass your place and think you're being okay. But unless you can tell everyone downstream how to work together, you can't guarantee that you're not drawing that creek down too low. My tank takes in between a quarter and a half a gallon a minute, and I turn the pump on once a day, and I have all the water I need. But that quarter gallon a minute does not significantly strand fish or alter the flow of that creek. So if I can ask people to do one thing, it is never draw directly out of a creek. And we can talk about how to do that. This is a trickle fill pipe with a valve so I can control the amount of water going into the tank. So repair, and I'm going to jump back. I'm going to go through my repairs. Repair your leaks. Why? It's the cheapest thing you can do. On average, we lose 17% of our water to leaks in our system. You can get a 10 to 15% water conservation savings just by taking the time to repair your leaks. And that's cheap. I'm cheap. I want to go from the cheapest to the hardest. So next, reclaim. The good news is California now has a gray water law. So I don't know if everybody is aware of that, but there is a gray water law. You can now legally install gray water off of your washing machine, your kitchen sinks. You can find this if you come right down here to this website. They'll give you information on that. I can do that. It is graywateraction.org. Graywateraction.org. And that's a pretty good improvement for California. So, gray spelt with an E. Sorry for those out in radio land. Next, reclaim water. Rooftop rainwater collection. I'm going to talk about that a lot if I don't run out of time. This is a pretty fancy one in an urban environment. You can see it blends in with the house. It doesn't look funky. The keys in here is there's rooftop rainwater diverters that keep the water quality good. You don't need those, but they're pretty useful. It comes into a tank, a pump, and gets distributed. Okay, now I'm going to talk about innovative reclaiming water. This is Tom Miller's house. It's on a ridge, no creeks, no anything. This rooftop on his house, I think it's about 2,000 square feet, fills 41,000 gallons of water tanks every year. So he has enough water off of that system. And here's the collection in the rooftop, and here it is coming down into the ground, and it gravity feeds down in buried lines from there to these water tanks. He has the ugliest water tanks in the world. He also uses drought landscaping in his house, and I don't like his taste in landscaping, but he does, and that's all that matters. And the other thing is that he uses drip irrigation. When he does take his 41,000 gallons of stored rainwater, he maximizes the benefit of it. And I'll come back and talk to you about what he did that I think everyone should take a lesson from. Another conservation device to consider. We're still at the reduced water demand. So that was reclamation of water. Now we're reducing water demand. This is wicking beds, and I like this website, milkwood.net. And this is probably one of the most efficient ways to create gardening or using water in your gardening. Plus, you get a lot of other benefits in this. So there's a series of pictures here, and I think we will post this somewhere. So we'll post this somewhere. And this one even comes with your own worm bed and compost bed that you build it.
For that too?
This is all milkwood.net. And if you just Google wicking bed, you'll get to this. Sure. I can do that. Well, maybe. We'll see. Okay, so you're obviously building your hole in the ground to receive your actual bed. And what they're doing is they're putting in a waterproof liner in the hole in the ground, and then they're putting in a perforated pipe system that will provide water to the bed. So with the impermeable layer within the bed and the water delivery system consisting of a perforated pipe, they're able to make 100% of that water available to the targeted plants you're growing. And then you build up your soil amendments in here, and then you can see they put a ring of galvanized pipe around it. Now, what I have, and I noticed when I came into your town how many water tanks you guys have, which is great, and there's a lot of water tanks around here. What I have is old water tanks that are cracked, and I cut them. And then I use those as my impermeable bed and as my my surface portion. So then you add a composting bin for your earthworms, and then you bring in your topsoil. And what you do is you pour the water in through your leach field pipe, and then it actually stays there and has absolute contact with the roots of the plants you're trying to grow. So if you have a xeric landscape like Tom Miller's ugly front yard, but you have these beds, you can be highly productive in growing the foods you need and all of that. So I think this is a really excellent way to go. I like it. Again, reduce water demand. Find ways to xeric landscaping, plant drought tolerant species, kill the lawn entirely. Skip the annuals in your garden this year. In other words, and this is probably one of the more controversial things if I can, I'm asking people don't grow gardens this year. I know people argue I need them economically, or it's more efficient to produce my food locally than have it shipped from somewhere else and buy it. The problem is, just like that beaver dam, we're making hard choices. Are we going to keep the fish, or are we going to have fresh organic produce? And I'm sorry to tell you, this year, ecologically, you got to go for keeping the fish. So, highly controversial, I hope. Consider killing your garden. Here are some other tools if you don't want to kill your garden. Just some simple devices. You can see these at benmeadows.com or forestsupplier.com. And these are a series of water bags that direct flow straight into the targeted reach that you're working on. And these are particularly good if you're going to keep your perennials, because you can get the water to them. The downside to these is you're spending a lot of time running a hose over and filling bags. But that's, you know, if you have your gray water system tied into this, perfect. Here's a controversial one. Don't grow pot this year. Weaverville again. This year, from September 2013 through January 2014, we got 3.5 inches of rain. Our average for the same period is 22.2 inches of rain, 1/7 of the rain that we normally would get. In the Trinity River, the Trinity River is diverted into the Sacramento River, and it flows down to a place called the Westlands Water District, which is about 1 million acres of agricultural land in the desert. The farmers in Westland know more about what's happening in the Trinity River every year than the residents of the Trinity River, because they are 100% economically dependent on the rainfall that falls in the Trinity River. If the Trinity doesn't get water, they don't plant their crops. So it's exactly the same thing for us. We didn't get water this year, guys. We don't have the water to meet our needs. So my recommendation is farmers in the valley have already not bothered to plant. They didn't order the seed. They didn't order the orchards, the seedlings. They didn't order anything. They are fallowing their land because they simply know there is not enough water to meet their demands. I don't know the percent. Actually, there's an article in today's Time Standard that talks about it. So
they were told that they couldn't get any water for ag this year. They knew that a month ago, and they didn't order seeds.
Right. Yeah. So they are going to pump the groundwater out. You know, they're going to rely on their other water sources. But you can see, everyone should know CDEC. CDEC. Every day, anyone who wants a garden, has a surface water diversion, or is a farmer, should know exactly what's happening in their watershed with their rainfall precipitation. It's actually, CDEC. Again, rethink water demand. If everyone is on systems that do not pull off the surface water, or at least doesn't dramatically drop it, it gives our fisheries and our other aquatic resources a chance to survive. Enough of that. Water withdrawals. So if you do have to draw out of the creek, I absolutely don't want to. I guess my time's up. But I have to draw water out of the creek, but I don't want to. Be aware, every person needs to become a water otter. So, for instance, just give you an example. If you draw water out of the creek and you draw it at the top of a 5-foot pool, you jump in that pool and you put your hand in the top of the pool, it's about 8 degrees warmer than it is 5 feet below. So if you're drawing from the bottom of the pool, you're drawing the cold water, versus if you're drawing from the top of the pool, you're drawing the warm water. Why is that critical? Water temperature is directly related to the amount of oxygen available in the water for fisheries. So if you're drawing cold water, you're taking away the higher oxygen water for those fisheries. So it's simply even being aware of how I position my pump or my hose in a creek can make a difference on whether the fish are going to survive or not survive. Another thing to consider is that an individual mature Douglas fir tree draws 100 gallons of water a day. An acre of mature fir trees draws 1 million gallons of water a year per acre. So when do they draw that water? They draw that water from noon till about 6 or 7 at night. That's the peak of the time that their roots are pulling water up and doing what's called evapotranspiration. They're pulling the water up and they're pulling it through the stem and up to the leaves where it's evaporating. If you're going to pump water and you're looking at your creek, and you can do this, go watch your creek at 8 a.m., noon, 4 p.m., 8 p.m., and 8 a.m. And guess what? From about 10 p.m. till about 8 or 9 in the morning, that creek is actually flowing at its highest levels. So if you have to draw water out of the creek, draw it at a time when there's more water in the creek. Draw it late at night. Draw it early in the morning. But now what happens if 10 of you draw all your water late at night at the same time? You've defeated the purpose of it. And so we have to think like the watershed. You have to be aware of what's going on. So let me give you the one exception to that. If you're up where I live at 7,000 feet, the water flows the most in the middle of the day because the sun's melting the snow and you get a big runoff. Except this year we have no snow. So what can I say? Stepping back, Dana says I can keep going. Sorry, guys. Stepping back, Tom Miller again has 41,000 gallons of rooftop rainwater. What Tom did is he planted a small vineyard using drip irrigation, and he knew that grapes need water for about 2 years. The most amount of water they need is in the first 2 years. Once established, the water demand goes down. So he planted this little vineyard on the ridge. He waited 2 years. He planted a second vineyard downslope. He waited 2 years. And then he planted an orchard, which needs constant water. So he actually was able, just by thinking about it, to more than double the amount of area he could utilize his rooftop rainwater on. And let me tell you really quick, how much did his system cost? Okay, it cost $19,000 for those really ugly tanks that he has. So $19,000, that's a lot of money, unless you think that we're in a drought and we're in a persistent period of drought, in which case after about 3 or 4 years, that's looking pretty darn cheap as an investment. We need to find a way in California to incentivize people to be able to do that. We have a backward system. And I hope we'll all mobilize on this. We need a way to give tax credits and give tax breaks for people who are investing in this type of activity. And that's one of the biggest areas, I think, long-term. Scott, you know, he's talking about look at the long-term. These droughts aren't going away. And by the way, anything you do to conserve water actually also reduces peak storm discharges, which also actually helps on the other end of the cycle when we're getting a lot of flooding. So we can't do this all individually. And I want to step back. By the way, the pot growers are not the problem. What they are is the next straw in the creek. We all have straws in the creek. They just happen to be the next group. And why do we target them? In part, it's because what they do by the nature of it has to be somewhat secretive. We can't go out to them, to the Farm Bureau of Growers, and say, we need to monitor your activity. We have to guess at what's going on with them. So I don't want to villainize them per se. I just, the combination of them having to be secret and hard to reach, hard to educate, hard to monitor, hard to tell what's going on, along with being the critical straw or the last straw in the creek, has made them more of a target. But they're not the problem. They're just one of the problems. We have to do a lot of things. We have to get into forest thinning. We have to reduce the stands, both because fire frequency, fire intensity is greater, and because we just simply have overstocked the stands and we're putting too much taxing on the land base. We have to restore fire in the system. We need to recognize that fire is an important component, and we have to control how we reintroduce that fire and not let it control us. I think I'm done. Restoring hill slope hydrology is huge. We have miles and miles of road that act like mid-slope creeks. And what they do is the water's coming down the slope, it hits the creek, the road, it runs sideways down the road, goes into a different creek, which is getting a lot more water than it used to. It's washing it out and creating problems. So we need to find ways and still manage our forests, but we need to reduce our overall road system. And now I'm done.
All right, that was Mark Lancaster with the Five Counties Soil Monitoring Project. Again, that's Five Counties. You can look that up on the internet as well.
Just checking to see if this is on. Yep. So my name is Brian Johnson, and I work for Trout Unlimited, like the fish. We're a conservation group that works any place that has trout or steelhead, in this case, and salmon. And I'm also a water lawyer and was asked to be here to talk a little bit about the water rights question, which is complicated, and we've pretty much established that a lot of things about it don't make sense. I'll try to be short, partly because we really want to leave room for questions, but also just on the general premise that water rights aren't always things to talk about in polite company. And I'll be here afterward and can talk, more quietly with folks who have, particular questions about, things that are more specific. So I'm just going to touch really briefly on the importance of recording water rights and what it takes to add storage, because, that's one of the things that, as folks have said here, is really obviously good for water supply security and also obviously can be very good for fish and for stream flow. And then a little bit about specifically what it takes to get water rights for storage, because that's kind of a separate category. So I think a lot of folks in coastal areas, and maybe some of you have been gotten notice from the state in recent years about changes in the law that tighten up the requirements for recording water rights and reporting diversions. And what I would say about that, the only thing I would say about it is that there's a downside risk to not doing it because the state can come down on you. But there are also good reasons why folks who live in an area would want to have the water rights recorded. And they may not be obvious, but as things get drier and as we look more like the rest of the West, there may be some benefits to having the water rights recorded. Among other things, the system gives preference to drinking water and public safety. And so can provide a layer of protection for families and safety in a time of real drought. It also provides protection to people who exist and have been in a place for a long time and existing uses, and makes it hard for, it's one of the things that would make it hard for somebody with a lot of money to come in and build a dam upstream and take all the water and ship it over the hill, because there's protection built in for existing uses, and with the, if the water rights aren't recorded, there's risk to those uses from, you know, things that can happen. And that's all I'll say about it, but I know it's a hassle for people and it's caused a lot of angst in many parts of the state, but there are also some benefits to it. I think people have probably seen the SRF brochure over here. If you haven't, I would definitely take a look. It breaks down some of the basic categories of water rights, and in a very easy to understand and accurate way. I'll just briefly mention a couple of them. Roof rainwater doesn't require a water right, and we clarified that officially with the state a couple of years ago. That's always been the law, but there was some uncertainty about it. In Colorado, for what it's worth, that wasn't the law. They have a long enough history of fighting over water that people who installed roof rainwater were getting sued by downstream neighbors. And we had to go to the legislature, actually, to get that changed so that people could do it. But it's always been the law in California. And then there's a category that we call riparian rights, which are, the nice thing about them is that they come with a land if for a parcel that's adjacent to a stream. And they're also senior, even if they haven't been used already, which is sort of a strange concept for people in other Western states that don't have this idea of a riparian right. But they're also very limited. They might be senior, but they're not necessarily reliable because they don't allow for storage and they don't allow for transport of water across multiple parcels or across a hillside, or using water that's been stored upstream in another reservoir and then, you know, moved down to the point. And so, and one of the really unfortunate things that really doesn't make sense about California water law is that's the kind of water right that people have automatically and they're the easiest to get and you just record them and say that you have them, but they don't allow people to do all of the stuff that's useful. And so, for storage, in particular, we need something else. And I'll come back to that, in just a second, when I talk about some of the, you know, new ideas that we're working on for people to get those. We do now, though, I should mention, and Mark did a good job and other speakers of covering a lot of the different types of things that people have been able to do. And just want to say, though, that we do now have examples in coastal California of people who have successfully added storage ponds and gotten all the permits and not had too much trouble with the state. And quite a few examples of people who have added tanks for drinking water and incidental domestic use, Tasha's programs and others, really large rainwater tanks, you know, buried rainwater tanks under parking lots for hundreds of thousands of gallons, people who have had success demonstrating recharge of water through rain gardens and swales and types of things. And so there's really good news there that, unlike 10 years ago, we really have a lot of models, and people who are interested in any of this can ask Dana or Tasha or me or Scott and you know, any of us up here and a lot of people in the room, and we can get good examples of what the technology looks like and where to buy it and so on. The one thing that I would mention that Mark didn't is, and I think it's really smart, especially in a year like this, to be really conscious of every little detail of a diversion. The one other thing that might work for some people, if there are a cluster of neighbors on a small tributary and you know each other, is to talk to each other about rotating the diversions. And you do it at night and you take turns and you have the inset, you know, trickle diversions. That could make a big difference. And we wouldn't have things like his picture where, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and all the pumps come on at once. Okay, so on the water rights for storage, the one that I'm going to cover in detail, and we can talk about others afterwards if people have questions, is what we call a small domestic use registration. And it's a type of appropriative water right, but it's much less bureaucratic than other types of appropriative water rights. And they have some limitations, but they're, I think, potentially useful to a lot of folks in rural residential areas of the coast, Eel River and Mattole. And it's a way to get a streamlined 5-year-old or 5-year running renewable permission to store water for domestic use, and it includes a half acre of outdoor irrigation use. And from the water code's point of view or the state's point of view, it doesn't matter what the outdoor use is. It's all irrigation. So whether it's a lawn or an orchard or whether it's a garden for your own use or you're making preserves and selling them down at the market, none of that matters. It's just a half acre of incidental to domestic. And I think that's, everybody that I've talked to anyway is just figuring out how they can add storage and how we can add as much as possible and affordable. And even if it's, doesn't rain more this year and it's too late for this year, we could have another one next year. We could have 10 in a row. Adding storage is really the thing that everybody's focused on. And I think the small domestic registration is probably the –